This episode of the UAV Digest is sponsored by Go Engineer, provider of design, engineering, and 3D printing solutions for the aerospace and unmanned vehicles industries. To learn more, visit the UAVDigest.com/GoEngineer. You're listening to episode 66 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I'm David Vanderhoof in spooky Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Happy Halloween, everyone.
Yeah, that's right, Halloween. You never know what's going to happen on Halloween. Sometimes you get more tricks, sometimes you get more treats. This episode, though, I think it's all treats, David. We've got some news plus some more from the NBAA panel discussion that we talked about last week.
Yeah, we got a lot of good feedback on that, but let's talk about it. So for our Halloween special, we've got which drones are getting brooms. See what I did there, folks? Satcoms for UAVs. Another one from the Your Grounded file, this time a UK incursion. The New York Police Department worries about terrorists and drones. And, of course, we're going to go talk more about the NBA audio. And we've got a video of the week that's kind of ghastly and painful to watch, and really good listener mail. So I guess we better get started, huh, Max?
All right, let's get started.
Well, our first news story of the week, just in time for Halloween. These drones with little brooms keep solar panels clean. This was from fastcoexist.com. Solar panels get dirty, and when they get dirty, they don't gather as enough sun. So what do? You send in the drones.
Yeah, this is something from a startup company, Aerial Power Limited. And the idea here is that there's a brush-carrying UAV that keeps the solar panels clean. I guess this is a problem, particularly in desert installations, which of course is where you can find lots of sun and is a great place to generate electricity, but it's kind of dusty out there. And so typically you have, people go out and manually clean the panels. Aerial Power Limited is testing this thing that they call Solar Brush. It's sort of an add-on, isn't it, David, for commercially available UAVs?
So you get your DJI Phantom and attach this little broom, and you fly up and down the solar panels, and it takes off the dust. It's kind of interesting, but I was thinking about, we talked about the solar panels and the birds and the environmental hazard. I wonder what the temperature's like operating over the solar panels for like a DJI Phantom.
I think for these kind of panels, it'll be safe. I think the one where they had problems with the birds getting sort of cooked was the type of facility where an array of mirrors direct the sunlight up to a common point, and that's where the temperatures
you're right.
rise. And in these, Aerial Power says that depending on where the drones are deployed, it may lower maintenance costs for solar power by up to 70%. And raising energy production by up to 30%. Pretty significant. Now, I'm not exactly sure how this works. I mean, when I think about if I had a brush in my hand and I was going to brush the dust off a solar panel, how do you make a little drone do that same kind of wrist action? I'm sort of curious to see how this works.
I was visualizing it like the broom actually is like a squeegee, and you basically tow the squeegee down the solar panel.
Well, I was looking for more information, and I found a video on YouTube. I also noticed that it had no views so far, and it went up today. So I think actually I might have been the first viewer.
There you go.
There we go. And I was hoping that it would sort of illustrate how this works, but it really was sort of a text kind of display, like a PowerPoint presentation kind of a display only. So we hope to see some more information from Aerial Power in the future, maybe kind of describe in more detail just exactly how this works, because it's certainly an interesting use case for drones.
All right. The next one was something we came up in conversation last week on the NBAA article, and this was from Satellite Today, which seems to be a lot of drone talk on a satellite publication, but UAVs and the need for satellite communications, or SATCOM. Different industries debate the potential of UAVs and the need for satellites. And, of course, we're talking about communication and encryption and bandwidth. And right now, a lot of the UAVs are using Wi-Fi. And it's not very secure. And it's what do you do when you're flying multiple vehicles? You know, when in the radio control world, you have a box locker and you go get your box to fly your airplane when you're ready to fly it. But part of that checkout of that box is you take out, when you take out your box, you need to make sure that currently there isn't anybody flying on the same frequencies. And normally then that person's done flying it. They lock their box into the lock box, and then you can pull out yours. Or remember, anybody who's had racing radio control cars, they usually come with two different frequencies because you have to override them. Well, drones are the same way. And imagine a sky full of commercial drones. They're going to have to be frequencies allocated to them. And what do you do when you have two drones that are flying with the same frequency? And Wi-Fi isn't the right to do it. It's got to be satellite communication.
And I think what we're seeing here is in this industry publication is this particular industry, the satellite industry, is kind of looking around and seeing all this drone stuff going on and seeing all the applications and possibilities. And as you say, David, they're kind of looking at all that and saying, gee, you know, we think we have a role in this, and it's an emerging market, and there's lots of business opportunities, and probably we should work together on this rather than have the UAV folks kind of trying to figure this out on their own. They, as the satellite industry, see that this is an opportunity for them. And, you know, it occurs to me, David, that we'll probably see a lot of other industries sort of wake up, if you will, take a look at what's going on in the unmanned aerial vehicle industry and see how they can link their business to that growth. We'll probably be seeing a lot of this
if we ever get the authorization to start flying UAVs. However, that brings us to our next article, which is another one of our "You're Grounded." Please stop giving our drones a bad name. And this one was really serious, and it occurred in May 2014 at Southend Airport in the UK. And it looks like there was a really close incursion.
Yeah, quadcopter came close to this ATR-72 that was on final approach to Southend Airport, as you say. And what we have now is the report from the UK Airprox board. And we'll put a link to the board in the show notes. We would put a link to the actual report, but you have to go through a page where you accept their terms and conditions before you can get to that, so you can't get to it directly. But we'll have information about it in the show notes. But this report describes the situation. It says, as the aircraft was about to intercept the ILS glide slope, the pilot saw a remote-controlled quadcopter very close to the right wingtip. The aircraft captain did not see the quadcopter, but the sighting was reported to the Southend ATC. The co-pilot formed the impression that the quadcopter had been flown deliberately close to the ATR-72 because he had seen it around 100 meters away as it approached from the right-hand side and made a turn to fly in the opposite direction to his aircraft, around 25 meters away and at the same level. This is pretty scary if you've got, you know, someone flying a UAV up to take a look at a commercial airplane.
We're not going to condone formation flying with airliners. We've had here in the States incursions where people have, the reports have been dubious, or this is pretty clear cut. I mean, they said it was a quadcopter. 25 meters off of a wingtip is close enough to know, to be able to see at the end of your wing that there's a quadcopter sitting there at a reasonable altitude. It, unfortunately, needless to say, they didn't find the guy flying the quadcopter, but this is as bad as someone pointing a laser at a pilot at a cockpit on the final, on a final. Is so these things give us droniacs a bad name.
I was curious as I was reading the report to get to the end of it and the conclusions and see where they were going to take this. And unfortunately, it's nowhere. As you said, David, there was no way for them to find out who was operating this quadcopter. And so the report basically concludes that, well, there wasn't much that could be done here. Kind of discouraging.
Other than report it, yeah.
Other than report it, yeah. Yeah.
But we need to keep, as an industry, putting pressure on stupid people who doing stupid things, you know. And we, unfortunately, we're going to talk about these more and more as more and more people are flying helicopters and quadcopters. And where we've talked about other ones where people have claimed, well, they didn't know any better. The whole flying up to and formating with, and it does sound a bit like I dare you to do it kind of thing and kind of stunt. Like, luckily, they were a good, I'll give them the benefit of the doubt and say they were a good pilot of the quadcopter, because otherwise it could have been really serious.
Yeah, and just one maybe last comment from me on this is that it's quite possibly another example of people who are now able to participate in the airspace, but who don't have the proper appreciation for maintaining a safe airspace. And, you know, it's quite possible that this person thought that, wow, this would be cool. I mean, I won't get too close, and without really realizing the implications and what they were doing. I think it's most likely that rather than somebody who's deliberately trying to cause a problem. But it kind of goes back to that awareness issue or the certification of pilots for UAVs issue that the FAA is looking at. And actually, we're going to have something about that in a few minutes when we talk about the NBAA panel discussion.
So talking about threats, this was from CBS New York, Channel 2. New York Police Department, threat of terrorists with drones is a growing concern. Well, we've had a lot of incidents in New York with people inadvertently doing dumb things with drones. But the New York Police Department does not have any specific threats, but they're suspicious, they're worried, and they're coming up with their own scenarios based on the fact that last year alone they had 40 incidents with drones.
It's kind of a problem. I can understand where the NY PD is coming from. I mean, they see reports. The article mentions a video of a drone with a paintball gun that's quite accurately hitting targets. Now, the police department is not particularly concerned, I think, about paintball guns, but just the concept that maybe you can weaponize a drone, and if you can, you know, where that might lead. The article mentions the event last year when the German chancellor was at a podium and a drone comes by, kind of flies with impunity. And they, you know, wonder about, well, how else could drones be used, and what would they have access to that they couldn't protect, things like that. So we see that they're consulting with the military, the police department is, and they're working out a plan to counter weaponized drones. But this might be a tough thing because, you know, there's not a lot to go on in terms of identifying what the threats might be and how you can counter them. But I got to give the NYPD a lot of credit for looking at this.
Yeah, and hopefully they'll disseminate the information to the other cities there. Unfortunately, New York anymore has got to be at the head of the threat intelligence and terrorist activities because of after 9/11, they're still regarded as a prime target. The New York Police Department's got to be ahead of the curve on this. So, but let's move on to bigger and better and brighter things. Is this the second installment, or is it going to be the second out of three installments?
No, it's not the final installment because we've got a lot of good content from this NBAA, the Business Aviation Convention and Exposition that was recently held in Florida. And this, again, is from the panel discussion that was titled Unmanned Aircraft Systems, Regulatory and Legal Developments. And we've got a little bit more to add to what we had last episode. And first, we'll start off with the moderator, Mark Warren. He's from Crowell and Mooring. And he asks the panel, do you have to be a pilot to fly UAS? And we start out with Dean Griffith from the FAA providing an answer. And then we've got Ted Wersbanowski, who's from the ASTM. And he also adds in. So here they are.
Okay, so here's my follow-up question. And I throw it open to all of you guys because I think it really is the 800-pound gorilla. And I'm going to go ahead and just put it right on the table. So you said you don't have to be a pilot to fly UAS. And geez, you know, you look at a lot of these guys who are hobbyists and they're flying quite capable aircraft. Yes, they have to comply with some requirements. But in general, if they do, the FAA can't even regulate them. They're not pilots. And so, then we have the so I guess the question to the group is, so is there not some inherent safety issue with that? And the converse is that the FAA, when it granted these Section 333 exemption requests, mandated that the MPAA operators hold a private pilot certificate. So what's up with that? How do you reconcile that?
Yeah, let me start, and no doubt Ted and Dean will want to chime in. For hobbyist use, private use of a civil UAS, I don't imagine you would need to be a pilot. Of course, the rules are subject to change, and that could be, but I think that we all can see today you don't really need to be a pilot and have all the training to fly a small UAS within visual line of sight. If you are flying commercially, I believe that there's a higher expectation that you are subject to some form of regulation, some form of training requirements, be it a regular pilot's license or some other variant. I know the Air Force, the DOD, has really said all of their unmanned aircraft pilots are going to be pilots and be trained as such. So it really depends on the use of the UAV. I think I would imagine most commercial uses would require a pilot's license.
Ted?
On the small UAS aviation rulemaking committee that I co-chaired in 08, we had representatives from HALPA, AOPA, Helicopters Association International, and a bunch of other pilots, including myself. And we debated that issue quite a bit. We came up with a set of recommendations that is available on the web that we gave to the FAA. And we didn't recommend that you actually had to be a stick and rudder pilot to fly a small UAS. But what you did have to do is be trained to understand the airspace that you're flying in and understand aviation. In fact, that's one of the reasons we go around and talk a lot to some of the folks that fly these things, especially since these quad rotors have basically exploded over, and not in a bad sense, but basically exponentially have been out there now. Most of the folks flying those don't understand aviation. They don't understand airspace. So our recommendation to the FAA, which I hope they're going to include in the NPRM, is a rigorous set of training requirements for whoever's going to fly these things. Now, they don't need to be stick and rudder folks. In fact, what some of the industry has found is that someone that, especially for small UASs, that used to fly a stick and rudder, you know, a real pilot, they're not as good as some of these young people that have been trained with the PlayStation. You'll go look at the ground control station that we have in the back. It looks like a PlayStation. And the reason it looks like that is because that's what all you need to fly these things. And you
also— so that's very interesting. The line is commercial or not, or at least that's the proposal. And again, the ASTM has been asked or had been asked to propose some standards to the FAA. We don't know if the FAA will accept all of them, part of them, modify them, or do what. That's what we find out when the NPRM comes out in this year, before the end of the year.
I like the comment he made about the fact that there's a lot of pilots that aren't very good UAV operators.
Yeah, true. I'm sure that's true.
Because, and I know that's a fact because I've heard that for years from radio control pilots. There are radio control pilots who are quite capable pilots, but someone who's had lots and lots of flight time being a pilot sometimes really has a trouble adapting to the mindset of flying a radio controlled airplane, especially things like when you're inverted, the controls go reverse.
you know, and
right.
and looking at it from the outside in, you're not. So I'm not surprised at the statement that you know, flying small UAVs is for some pilots is not something easily switchable to.
And now we'll move on with Ted Wierzbanowski from the ASTM talking about, in more detail, the need for small UAS awareness.
One point I wanted to make is you probably don't realize this, but if you look at the financial records of some of these companies that are selling these little quadrotors that we all are beginning to love and whatever, there's hundreds of thousands, if not a million of those things in the U.S. right now flying. And Christmas time is coming up, and so there's going to be more. And our job as aviators is to educate those folks about what they should be doing and shouldn't be doing with those things, and they shouldn't be flying them on the approach end or near any airports or whatever. They should be flying them in accordance with whatever regulations or recommendations the AMA has.
All right, again, that seems reasonable to me.
Oh, I was just going to add that, you know, there was a suggestion in there that a hot major holiday is coming up. So if you want to get in the good graces of Max and I, we will accept any quadcopters that you might want to send our way. No. That wasn't the point of that segment. I'm sorry.
No. All right. Let's finish up with Ted on the ASTM recommendations to the FAA.
So I don't believe for small UASs that you need to be a stick and rudder guy, but you really need to understand aviation. You need to understand the airspace so you know that you're close to an airport and you shouldn't be flying there, at least whatever regulation you put in, 5 miles, 3 miles, whatever. And that's what, after a bunch of debates, AOPA, helicopter guys, the ALPA folks, other pilots on the small rulemaking committee recommended. And we'll see what comes out in the regulation. The FAA is going to, instead of relying on consensus standards for that, as best I understand, they're going to include that in the NPRM.
All right. Next up, the moderator asks Dean Griffith from the FAA about why the Section 333 exemption requires a pilot private's certificate. You'll recall that this Section 333, this relates to the FAA Reauthorization Act from 2012. And Section 333 sort of bridges where we are now without regulations to the point where we do have them, and offers a means by which exemptions can be made to authorize the use of UAVs, but it does require a private pilot certificate. So here's that part.
And Dean, I won't put you on the spot about the NPRM because I know you can't comment, but I did note, as I mentioned earlier, the Section 333 grants of exemption required a private pilot certificate. Can you elaborate on why that is?
Sure, and this is actually a good example of some of the challenges we're facing as we're moving from what we call the accommodation phase of UAS, which is kind of where we are now, using COAs and et cetera to allow operations, moving into an integration phase where we have broad-based rules that allow people to operate, you know, without having to go through the kind of onesie-twosie method that we are now. The reason why we're requiring a pilot certificate, pretty simply, is that the 333 exemptions is that a pilot certificate is required by statute to operate the NAS. That's one of the three things: the certificated aircraft, certificated pilot, and registered aircraft. And 333 gave us latitude on the airworthiness certification front, but not on the pilot side. So that's really the reason why, but I think it's also a good example of the FAA demonstrating some flexibility, because these operations, if they were conducted, the ones that the Motion Picture Association petitioners came in to us with, are normally operations for which you'd have to have a commercial pilot. And so what you see if you read the grant of exemption to the seven petitioners is that we went through and looked at what are the requirements, where do the requirements overlap between pilot and commercial, and does it really make sense to have those extra 150 hours, I believe it is, stick and rudder time that get you to that commercial level when you're flying a UAS, and really is the private pilot level more appropriate? So that's where we came down on that.
Well, I think we need to move on a little bit, but that just means we've got more for other episodes. Really interesting answer, though, you have to admit, Max, about the why the COAs that were granted were granted to pilots. Basically, the FAA is saying, well, Congress gave us leeway, but only gave us so much leeway. And to fly in the national airspace right now in the NAS, you have to be a pilot.
Yeah, in a way, they're saying, the FAA is saying, you know, guys, it could be a lot worse. We might not even have the ability to give these kind of exemptions. May be a situation where everybody has to wait. But what they're saying is that they have the flexibility to grant these exemptions. And without saying it this way, but sort of the underlying theme is be happy with what you've got because it could be a lot worse. All right, so we'll have more from the panel discussion coming up in a future episode or episodes. There's a lot more interesting things that were discussed, and we look forward to bringing them to you. But for this episode, David, what's up next?
Well, we've got videos of the week, it being Halloween when this gets released. What's the horror of your drone losing contact and going into return home mode? Well, the problem is if between you and the drone who's trying to go home to you is a very large rock, what you get is a very bad situation.
It sure was. This is something from Every Angel Films. They were shooting a video of a sunrise at Pinnacle Peak, which is in Utah. Pinnacle Peak is sort of this large column of rock. And they were shooting some really beautiful video with a brand new GoPro 4. It was mounted on a DJI F550 with a H3 3D gimbal. This is not an inexpensive setup. And you know, when the F550 lost contact, it returned home only to crash really heavily into Pinnacle Peak, which was in its way. What this makes me think about is, you know, are we assuming that, you know, we have safe, you know, mature systems here, you know, or not? What if this, instead of being out in a remote area of Utah, was instead near a populated area, and you had that kind of loss of contact, or, you know, a return to home was initiated, and the UAV flies into the side of a building because it doesn't know that there's a building between it and home.
And knowing the way the technology is moving in 5 years with sense and avoid technology, which is really what this is sense and avoid, it might not be an issue anymore. But you got to admit it is impressive how that the GoPro, what makes this video so amazing is the GoPro keeps kind of like that accident we had where the GoPro went for a swim with the DJI right. Phantom, and you got to see the lovely underwater waterbed. In this case, you get to watch every bounce, boink, and thump all the way as the poor F550 crashes to the ground.
There was a lot of damage. I don't know how much damage to Pinnacle Peak, or even isn't that a national park, David? I'm not sure that that would be an allowable location to fly to. But in any event, it's a pretty dramatic crash, and it's all captured. You know, in the first part of it, the sunrise, it's really gorgeous. The scenery is very good. We had another one. This actually came in from Drone Mama, and I had to put this in. This is a video from a Japanese band, OK Go. And what this is this was filmed entirely from a drone, with a little support from about 2,400 people. And we'll put a link, obviously, in the show notes, along with a link to a story from CNN that describes this. Last I checked, there were over 8 million views, so I guess that qualifies as having gone viral. But it's really a creative piece of work. When you're looking at it, you might think it's animated or it's CGI or something like that. It's not. So that's our second video of the week.
And of course, when we have a new patron, we've got to give him a shout out. So we'd like to say thank you to Wayne. And Wayne, your donation, you get to spend a half hour chatting with us on a Google Hangout. So we're going to have to get that arranged from you. And that will also lead into our feedback.
Yeah, we heard from a couple of folks who really wanted us to continue with the NBAA panel discussion clips. And so we've done that. Todd sent us an email on that, and so did Keith. So thanks to you guys, or maybe because of you guys expressing the interest, we're going to continue to do that.
And the next one was one of those stories that everybody decided that, especially from our Australian counterparts, Ray, who's a longtime Airplane Geeks listener, Steve Vischer, our compadre from Airplane Geeks, who descended to me with the twist that it was the Dutch that created this, and our friend Ben, our friend Jonesy down in Australia, all sent us this about a ambulance drone prototype that's got a built-in defibrillator. Now, my question on this is, when the drone gets there, is the person going to be able to figure out how to convert the drone to the defibrillator? But it is kind of, it's kind of very science fiction. You can imagine you're in the office and someone's having a heart attack, and suddenly somebody hits a button and a drone flies around the corner and lands next to you, and you have a perfectly good defibrillator and you save your coworker. So it's a novel concept, and it's another one of those, I would have never put a defibrillator next to a small UAV. Would you have, Max?
I certainly wouldn't have thought of that, but in terms of, you know, speed of response, that might offer some sort of life-saving capability. So, yeah, interesting.
So, where can they find us, Max?
Well, you can find us at theuavdigest.com. That's where you'll find all the show notes. Since this is episode 66, you can go straight to those notes at theuavdigest.com/66. You can send us email to feedback@theuavdigest.com. Of course, we're also on social media, David.
We've got a very active Twitter account at UAV Digest. And of course, our Facebook account, which is facebook.com/UAV Digest. If you listen to us on iTunes, leave us a review saying how well we are. That way other people can find us. Do we mention Stitcher now that it got bought?
Yeah, Stitcher.com. We're on Stitcher. Stitcher was acquired or bought by a European company, but we understand that things were going to continue as they are. And we also have some swag at our Cafe Press store. You can find that at cafepress.com/theuavdigest. And finally, if you'd like to become a patron of the podcast, you can visit our website and click the link there. And we appreciate that.
So with that note, this ends our spooktacular UAV Digest. And I'm David in Philly.
And Max in Hartford.
Thanks for listening.
This episode has been sponsored by UAV Propulsion Tech, a provider of propulsion, servo, and rescue and recovery parachute solutions for the unmanned aerial vehicle market. For more information, check out www.uavpropulsiontech.com.